By the time a bulldogger's getting off of his horse and dropping down onto the neck of that steer, they're probably going 25 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour,
Yeah, I would say so. Something like that.
somewhere in that range. And so the steer's running at that speed as well. And now this human has got to stop the forward progress of that steer
Yep.
that, probably weighs 500 pounds, somewhere in that zone, get him turned around 180 degrees and then throw him on the ground so that all four of his legs are no longer connected to the earth. And the guys that are pretty fast at that are doing it in how much time?
It depends a lot on how long the, when the barrier pulls. But, at rodeos like the National Fives and stuff, they routinely do it in 3 and 4 seconds.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. Four years ago, I bought a new truck for the first time ever, and I was so excited. It was incredible. It smelled good. It felt good. I wasn't constantly afraid of breaking down, It was awesome. But after I drove it for a couple weeks, I do the same thing that I always do, and the backseat started to fill up with stuff. I'm guiding elk hunters and deer hunters, and I'm duck hunting, and I'm fly fishing, and all that gear just accumulates. And pretty soon, I wasn't able to take people with me anymore, and I was embarrassed. People would ask for a ride, and like, nah, sorry, man, I've got too much stuff with me. But I couldn't put it in the bed because then it gets damaged by weather. So I go to the internet, and I'm looking for options, and I ended up buying a deck to drawer system. Now, this was a big purchase for me, but it's something that I felt like I needed, and it looked like it was going to be a good product, and it really was. Dekt came out with a new drawer system this year, and they've made some meaningful improvements over the previous one. You have almost no wasted space in your truck bed now, so you can access the sides of the drawers, and then the drawers roll a full 18 inches farther out, so you can actually access the back of the drawer, even if you don't have a lot of arm reach. There's some really strong tie-down points on top. They have a 400-pound load rating, so if you're going to haul something like a motorcycle or big coolers or whatever, you can really strap your gear down and make it secure. You can lock these drawer systems, so you can lock the drawers, or if your tailgate locks, then nobody can access the drawers anyways. So I actually feel like my stuff is more secure inside this drawer system than in the cab of my truck. That's a big deal to me. The complete deck system is made in America by Americans, and you know that that's something that I love and appreciate. They've got one that will fit in any truck or van that's been made in America in the last 20 years plus. You can go to decked.com/sixranch and get free shipping. But just being honest with you, they get free shipping to everybody. I also, while you're there, want you to check out their deco line. So they've got a bunch of different boxes and storage containers that either fit on top of or inside of the drawer system. And those are built really robust. I saw the prototypes at an event this summer. I'm impressed. I'm excited to get my hands on them. I haven't yet. But the prototypes were super badass. And the ones that are in production model, they're available now over at decked.com. So even if you just need a place for some tools, or you need a new bow case, or something along those lines, go check that out. And if you're driving around right now and your backseat is just full of gear and you can't haul people around, maybe you should consider looking at the full deck drawer system, because it's a good piece of gear. It was a good purchase for me, and I hope it helps you.
Well, the old timers around here say that snow doesn't stick to green grass. And I'd mostly only ever heard that in the springtime, when you get a little bit green up and then you catch that snow in May or June or whatever. But this fall, we've got green grass that looks like the end of April, and they're saying the same thing. What's your take on that?
I never even thought about it, but there's some truth to that, because if it's warm enough for the grass to still be green, The ground's probably warm enough to melt snow. And we got that big snow, and it was, I mean, we knew it was coming, but and it got really cold here. It got 4 below
Yeah.
one night, and but and I thought maybe we're in stuck for it all winter, but it warmed up and now it's gone.
Your family has quite a history there in the Big Timber area, doesn't it?
Well, I was raised over in the Madison Valley, over by Cameron and Ennis,
Okay.
and that's where I grew up. My dad was fairly well known. He was I think he was generally considered the best cowboy in the area, and I grew up thinking cowboys were somebody special.
Yeah.
So I had a lot to learn.
Well, I think cowboys are special, you know, they're workmen, but that brings up a question because it gets a little bit confusing sometimes about just what a cowboy is and what it isn't. So how would you define what is a cowboy?
I don't know. I'd give it a pretty broad definition. I always think cowboys have to ride horses and work cattle from horseback to some extent, and work with horses or livestock, cattle in particular.
Yeah.
Those are the main things, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to be a cowboy if you're running sheep, isn't it?
It is. Although actually some of those guys that do both are pretty good hands.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying that they're not handy, but cattle got to be involved.
Oh yeah, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think cattle and horses both have to be involved. And I don't, to some extent, I mean, rodeo cowboys are different than ranch cowboys. I mean, a lot of times that crosses over. I know a lot of ranch cowboys that rodeo, but there are quite a few rodeo cowboys that never worked on a ranch, or at least to any extent. So
Yeah, and that's sort of what I was leading into. I also think it's worth recognizing that cowboying is a profession, and if you're not doing that job, it's hard for me to call you a cowboy at that point. You know, if you grew up cowboying or you used to do that, but now you work in a bank and you still wear a cowboy hat and cowboy boots, doesn't make you a cowboy necessarily. Like, you're a banker. You just dress like one now.
well, you know that you're talking about me exactly, but I came home every night and broke horses, and a lot of times roped.
No, you're
So
still doing the
I
thing.
claim to be a cowboy.
Yeah.
It's a little bit you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. And there's a certain amount of that in you're most of the people I know that grew up on ranches or worked a lot on ranches, their heart's still there, no
Yeah.
matter what they're doing.
So when you're saying that your dad was respected as the best cowboy in the valley, how would people qualify that outside of the spectrum of rodeo? Because, you know, rodeo, we can
Oh,
kind of see who's successful and who's not, like
sure.
who's actually winning, and that's different. But if you're just talking about by reputation for the working cowboy, how do people come to that sort of consensus that this guy is the best cowboy around?
Well, I think it's, the people that he works with are the ones that start that. And my dad broke horses, and his horses were really worked well for people, for other people, and for himself. He ended up training horses a lot. A lot of the horses, the ranch I grew up on raised a lot of thoroughbred horses, and they sold them for polo ponies, and so that helped his reputation. And then if you worked around my dad in a corral, or like weaning time or something, he didn't get off and work cattle in that alley. We'd just drive the cows to him, the cows and calves to him. And he'd let the cows by and cut the calves back. And not everybody can do that. And some of that got out.
Yeah.
I mean, people just sort of one way or another, they just knew he was pretty good.
Yeah. And then did you feel like it was an obligation to carry that on? What made you want to continue with it?
I think I just wanted to do what he was doing. I liked it. I mean, I started riding and helping him move cattle when I was very small.
Yeah.
3 or 4 years old.
Yeah.
I used to sometimes ride on the back of the saddle with him, and we'd go off. He did a cattle herding job for a summer grazing association for several years, and when I was real young, and I started that. And as soon as I got my horse where I had to whip him a little to keep him going, but I went with him and did stuff. So I just started out doing it. I mean, I probably didn't rope until I was 6 or 7. I
Yeah.
didn't rope much then either. But.
Yeah. Were grizzlies a factor back then?
No, you know, that's something that's different. Where I grew up there, my dad saw a grizzly once up there, but there weren't any in the gravelly range. And up there in Ruby Creek, he saw a big bear that he thought was a grizzly once. And he said it was so big from a distance, he thought it was a bull.
Yeah.
But that was the only one I ever heard of until more recently. And since they've expanded the stuff from in Yellowstone Park and stuff, there's a hunter conflict with a grizzly bear there in that same country now frequently. And I think they're there year round. I mean, actually, I was thinking about going up there and riding to on a mountain that I'd always wanted to get to the top of, and I just decided not to because I didn't want to deal with the grizzly.
Yeah, that's kind of a sad reality of it now, isn't it? That people are having to make that decision more and more often. And, you know, is that conflict or the potential for it even worth being there? And the gravelies, you know, have a lot of grizzly conflict anymore. And I would
They do.
assume that the cattle that are still in that country, boy, that's got to be a big part of their lives.
You know, I suppose so. I don't have any direct knowledge on that.
Yeah. Are they in your area around Big Timber now?
No. I mean, there might be some south of here, more toward the park when you get up in the Absaroka Mountains, but I'm on the Crazy Mountain side, and I haven't heard of any grizzlies being over here.
Well, that's good news. That's good news. Now, I remember you being in a, and forgive me if I get the nomenclature wrong, but a senior rodeo league.
Yes, it was a there's the National Senior Pro Rodeo Association, and I used to rope in that for quite a few years. I haven't been for a couple of years, but I won't say that I won't. I might go back. I don't know.
And how old are you now, Jim?
I'm 73. My birthday's in about a month.
Okay, and you're still thinking about rodeoing, and weren't you bulldogging for a little while in that league
No.
too?
No, I didn't bulldog.
Okay.
When I was young, I was roping calves, and I tore my knee before I started to bulldog. I was figuring on it, but I didn't
Yeah.
do it.
Are there guys who are your age who are still doing rough stock events?
No, I would say there's very few guys over 50 that do much rough stock. You see a few bull riders at the senior rodeos that are over 50, but. Once in a while you'll see somebody in the saddle bronc riding or the barebacks, but that's for some reason the horses that tend to hurt old people more than bulls do.
Yeah.
That seems kind of counterintuitive, but I think that the horses withers. I think they tend to break pelvises is what they tend to do.
Yeah. Well, it's a hard landing when you're bareback riding, especially.
Oh, you know that, don't you?
Yeah, there's a, you know, even if you're saddle bronc riding, or bull riding, if you do everything right, you know, you can end that ride and not feel too awful bad. But bareback riding, if you do it right or do it wrong, you're hurting on the way out of the arena no
Yeah.
matter what.
Yeah. I watch it on television a lot and they show those real close-ups. You just wonder that anybody can do it.
What do you know about the history of rodeo?
Well, I don't know, a little. I know it started a long time ago, and it either started in Tech. The first rodeos were probably in Texas, although Prescott, Arizona claims to have the oldest organized rodeo. I don't know which one's which, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That was in the 1800s sometime. When I don't know when it started, when it got big enough to where you could make a living at it. Maybe in the maybe in the 30s or 40s, at least a few of the guys could.
Yeah. The first national finals was over here in Pendleton.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a great story called Wild Horse Rider about an Indian guy named Lou Miner who won the bronc riding on a horse named Angel. And it was there at Pendleton. So the Pendleton Roundup has a long history. And I think that there's a lot of that around the country, rodeos that have been going on for a century or close to it or longer. So and I'm sure that the events have changed a lot. You know, at the time they were saddle bronc riding with a stock saddle, you know, it had a saddle horn on it. And these ranch rodeo events, the folks who are bronc riding have a riata tied up to the front end of their saddle so that they can hold on to it. And they're allowed to hold with both hands, which makes all the sense in the world to me. I think if you can use both hands to help stay on the horse, that's probably the way to do it.
Well, I agree with you. The stories, you know, that you hear when you're young are, you know, you don't grab the leather and all that. But my dad told me when I was pretty young, he said they put that saddle horn on there for two reasons. And one of them is to tie a rope to, and the other one's to grab onto when you need it.
Yep. I agree with that. And I think if your hands are cold and you've got pockets, you should probably stick your hands in your pockets, you know, but some of
I fully agree. Ear flaps too. I use ear flaps, you know?
Well, sure. I mean, without the Stormy Cromer, Montana would fall.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your new book.
Well, I wrote a book. I've actually written several of them, but I call it A Montana Rivalry. It's the first of a series that I'm calling Rodeo in the Blood. It's got quite a little ranching in it, and a lot of rodeo. It's pretty complicated story. The core of the story is about two young men who fight the first time they meet when they're 7 years old and spend the next 20 years trying to outdo one another. And but there are a lot of other people in the story. Their parents, their mentors. Actually, they share a mentor that teaches them both to be steer wrestlers. I don't know. I guess I've a couple of times I've said it's a story of father, sons, love, and rodeo. It's kind of a, you know, there are a lot of characters and they all interact and on the ranch and then later in rodeo.
So there's a, I don't even know how to describe him. He's an author, but also an academic philosopher named Christopher Booker. And he wrote that there are only seven basic narrative plots and that every story that we tell and a lot of what we experience fall into those seven categories. And that's overcoming the monster, rags to riches, the quest, voyage and return, rebirth, comedy, and tragedy. And it sounds like your work is fiction. Is that correct?
It is fiction. It is fiction. I mean,
which of those threads do you feel like it would fall into?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, it's not a quest exactly, or it might. I mean, there's some aspects of a quest to it, because toward the end of the book, they're at the National Finals Rodeo competing against each other for the world championship in steer wrestling. So that, I guess that's kind of a quest, but I'd have to read that to see what I think about it.
Yeah. You know, I went to college at Montana Western with your daughter, Amber, and we lived together as roommates there for many years and we're very close friends. She was a goat tire and I was a bareback rider on the rodeo team there. But I also took steer wrestling as an elective, which I'd like to tell people about as a way of kind of describing what my college experience was like, because I think that most colleges don't offer steer wrestling as an elective.
It must have been the phys ed class.
Yeah, I guess so. But I didn't go to my steer wrestling class. I'm ashamed to say I skipped that one, but I did pass it. And the way that I passed it was the rodeo coach Ole came in and into my dorm room and got me up one day, and she said, "I need you to get in a fight tonight." And I was like, "Oh, geez, like what are you talking about?" And we had a boxing smoker as a fundraiser for the rodeo team, which they don't do anymore. Probably a good thing, but that's what we did at the time. And there was a rival rodeo team that wasn't able to make it, so she had to come up with a bunch of extra boxers. And I wasn't in any kind of shape. This was the end of my freshman year. I hadn't been doing much besides going to school and fly fishing and hunting a little bit. But I agreed to do it, and she said she'd find me somebody to fight that was going to make me look good, and that she was going to make it up to me. So I ended up fighting a kid named Albert Destajo, and I outweighed him by like 25 pounds. Albert was a Hawaiian kid, and he stepped into the boxing ring that night barefoot with his own boxing gloves and proceeded to just beat the crap out of me. And I wasn't able to drink any eat anything that was stronger than soup for about 3 weeks. And at the end of it, I passed steer wrestling without ever going a single time. And I'm pretty sure that's how old he made it up to me. But
Well, that seems fair enough.
yeah, not too bad of a deal, I guess. But you know, that's kind of what the experience of going to Montana Western was like at that time. And I'm sure it's changed since, on you know, for better or worse. But what's your favorite rodeo?
You mean my favorite ever, or
Yeah.
my favorite rodeo was the one in Ennis, Montana, my hometown, in 1975. I won the calf open there. If you can win your hometown rodeo, I think it's got to become your favorite.
Sure.
And
Well,
it's a it it was a big deal. The community, and the stands were packed. It was a nice day. My dad was running a stock out of the arena, and after I made my run, he came up, and while they were waiting for the 5 second thing or 6 seconds to go by so they could give an official time, I told him, I said, I just won the rodeo. I'd made a good run. And
yeah.
so that's my favorite rodeo.
I bet your dad is proud of you.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he
Yeah.
wasn't one to say too much about it, but yeah.
Do you remember Amber's promotion reel video that she made
Yes, I
for
do.
college? Do you remember the highlight of that video?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to tell that story?
Well, we're in White Sulphur Springs at a high school rodeo, and they had several. I don't remember. It must have been maybe her senior year, and she drew this nasty goat. She got off, and she was winning a lot of goat time at that time, and she was running toward the goat, and he jumped and butted her right in the head. And knocked her down. They were both down afterwards, and she got up and tied him. I don't think she placed, but she got up and tied him. She was mad at him because he bent her hat.
Yep. And when she turned around, she was good and mad, and I remember her horse seeing the look on her face, and her horse took off and didn't want to have anything to do with her. Oh, that was one of the funniest videos I have ever seen in my life. And I'm sure that Amber's cringing that we're talking about this, but
Maybe,
that's
but I'll take
too
the
bad
blame
for her. Yeah.
for putting that in that reel. I thought it showed a lot of try for her to get back up and tie that goat.
A huge amount of try. And, you know, to be honest, there's not a lot of women in the world that can headbutt a goat hard enough to knock him down.
That's true. I'll have to tell her you said that.
Why did you pick rodeo? I mean, it's obvious rodeo is in your blood. But why did you end up picking that subject as the background to carry this story?
Well, if you go to a writing thing, one writing class or something, they'll tell you to write what you know, and that was the start of it. And this particular story, I started a long time ago. I don't remember how I came up with the idea for it. I know that I hung on to that idea for a long time. I think I started right? And it's sometime in the mid 90s. And my life got really busy about then. And I would just sit down occasionally and write a scene that I knew would need to be in it. And I just sort of hung on for a long time. And then here a few years ago, I got my hip replaced and I had to just stay in the house for 6 weeks in a row. And so I really got going on it then. And in about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, I finished it.
Well, that's incredible. How much time a day were you spending working on it?
I don't remember, but probably a couple hours, two or three, twice a day, probably a good part of that time. It's hard to write more than 2 hours in a row. I mean,
Yeah.
for me, I don't know about for other people, but for me, but I got going on it, and I liked my characters, even though they were opposed to one another. I liked them both, the main ones, and I liked several of the other characters as well. And since then, I've written three more of them, and I'm working on another one right now. I'm just getting started, and I think I got around 6,000 words in it.
Who's the publisher?
These two have been Palmetto Publishing. It's a little press out of South Carolina.
Sure. Yeah, everything in South Carolina is named Palmetto something or other,
Yeah,
isn't it?
yeah.
Yeah. What was it like trying to take your book across the finish line and talk to publishers and get it pressed and kind of go through this promotion cycle? I mean, you know, my degree is in literature and writing, and there was only one class that we ever took that talked about how to get published, and it was called Writing for Publication. And you know, looking back, we probably needed a 100, 200, 300, and 400 level series of that class. Like that really should have been the goal, isn't just to, you know, learn how to criticize or study literature, but how to actually produce and participate in it in a way that you can, you know, pay back the cost of college at some point. So, you know, what was that process like for you?
It is really difficult. Actually, I started writing for publication in the 80s sometime. I started getting articles in magazines, a lot of them the Western Horseman, but others. I had one, the Reader's Digest, Persimmon Hill, that's the Cowboy Hall of Fame magazine. I even got one in Ag Banker. So I and got paid for that stuff, and I like that. But the trying to get somebody interested in publishing a novel set in the modern West is pretty tough, and I'm not good at that stuff. I hunted a long time before I found a press that would even talk to me, and then it cost me some money. So.
Yeah. Did at any point you consider like trying to find an agent to help you with this?
Yeah, actually, for the big publishers, if you don't have an agent, they won't even talk to you. They don't want to see your manuscript. I sent manuscripts to several publishers, but I never heard back from any of them. I sent samples to, I guess I sent mostly samples to the publishers, but I sent samples to probably half a dozen agents or maybe more. Never heard back from any of them.
Yeah.
So I had to go do this direct.
Yeah.
If I was going to get it done in my lifetime, it was going to have to be direct.
Well, that takes some tenacity and grit, and so does steer wrestling or bulldogging, which it's also called. And we've talked about this a little bit, but why don't you describe just what steer wrestling actually is?
Well, steer wrestling is it's a rodeo event, and I think it was kind of invented by accident, but you have a two riders. One is the steer wrestler, the other one's the hazer, and a steer. And the steer runs out of the chute. The hazer holds the runs out beside the steer and kind of holds him in straight so the steer wrestler can get off on him. And then they sort of grab the bull by the horns and they pull his head around and twist his neck and throw him down. And
Yeah.
sometimes, I mean, it's not always that simple. But that's the intent.
Right. So by the time a bulldogger's getting off of his horse and dropping down onto the neck of that steer, they're probably going 25 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour,
Yeah, I would say so. Something like that.
somewhere in that range. And so the steer's running at that speed as well. And now this human has got to stop the forward progress of that steer
Yep.
that, you know, probably weighs 500 pounds, somewhere in that zone. Get him turned around 180 degrees and then throw him on the ground so that all four of his legs are no longer connected to the earth. And the guys that are pretty fast at that are doing it in how much time?
You know, it depends a lot on how long the, when the barrier pulls. But, at rodeos like the National Fives and stuff, they routinely do it in 3 and 4 seconds.
Isn't
The
that
winners
amazing?
do. It
Yeah.
is kind of.
Yeah. And I think the fastest that I ever did it was like 8 or 9 seconds.
That, and when I was young, that was a pretty fast time. And I think they're one of, thing they might have been either they had longer scores, of which longer till the barrier trips, so you don't get a 10 second fine, and the cattle might have been bigger too. But since I was young, there have been a lot of progress in technique and things like that, so that and the rodeo schools that these young people go to and learn how to do it right, so everything's faster.
Yeah, including the horses.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You know, we raised Corrientes here, and mostly we sold them to team ropers and to stock contractors who were taking them to rodeos when we first got the Corrientes. But occasionally we'd sell them for bulldogging, and that was the absolute worst news that I could get, because that meant that I was going to have to go out there and train all these cattle on how to get bulldogged. And the reality of that is you're going to have ribs that are bruised.
Yeah.
Your knees are going to get tore up. You're going to lose every shirt that you ever try and do it in. And, you know, training cattle to team rope is pretty nice because, you know, you're not hardly getting off your horse unless you're moving them through a chute or something. But
Yeah.
Training them for bulldogging, you start by catching them right out of the chute, and man, I got tossed around a lot. Yeah, you learn how
I
to get
bet you
tough
did.
doing that kind of thing. So did you bulldog at all?
Actually, I threw a few steers on the ground, but I never did because
Yeah.
I think I told you I tore up my knee when
Right.
just before I was thinking of starting.
Now in team roping, and were you team roping or calf roping exclusively?
I team rope some, but I mostly rope calves.
Okay. Well, tell us about what calf roping is.
Well, they call it tie down roping now, but you rope a calf out of the chute off a horse, and then you when you get it caught, you get off and run down and throw it down and tie three legs together. And then when you get that done, then time is up, and the fastest one wins.
And he has to stay tied up for 6 seconds.
6 seconds, yep.
Yep. And how fast are folks getting this done in?
You know, the young guys like at the National Finals stuff are doing it in 7 and 8, and every now and then you'll see one in 6 seconds, something. But that's the really good guys. You know, that's amazing to me. I mean, there was when I was young, there was a book called 13 Flat that was about the best calf ropers in the world in the 50s and 60s, early 60s. And 13 Flat won't win you a nickel these days.
Yeah. I mean that's a lot to go on in 6 seconds.
It is.
You know that barrier rope that you're talking about. So this is a rope that they put around the animal's neck when it's down inside the chute, and you cannot get your horse out of the box because there's a box on either side of the chute. So your horse can't get out of the box until the calf has gotten far enough out and gotten a head start that rope breaks away from their neck. And it is a 10 second penalty if you do that. And if you incur a 10 second penalty, like you're out of it, completely out of it,
That's right.
unless every single person incurs a 10 second penalty. But yeah, it's incredible to give a calf that head start, get your horse out there, get that calf caught. Your horse has got to put the brakes on immediately, stop that calf. You've got to get off without falling on your face and run down there, get a hold of him, blank him, put him on the ground, and then wrap those three legs up with a piece of leather or rope or whatever you got. I suppose it's rope and calf roping, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a pig and string, and it's either nylon or hemp rope.
And get his legs wrapped up and throw your hands in the air to stop the clock. That is an incredible amount to do in any amount of time, much less 6 or 10 seconds.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a lot of fun to do it. I never did one in six. I the fastest I did one in eight. In those
Wow.
days, that was pretty fast.
And how old were you at that time?
Oh, 20 something, 23 or four probably.
Okay.
I'm not as fast as I once was.
How long have you been rodeoing for?
I went to a kids rodeo when I was probably 7 years old.
Yeah.
So that's 60 plus years, I guess, if you
That's.
go back that far. But I won my first calf roping when I was 16 or 17.
And did you win a buckle?
No, it was, but I won money, and which was suited me at the time. It was at a little rodeo in Island Park, Idaho, and
Okay.
in those days it was pretty wild deal. They had a the grandstand was there was no grandstand, but there was the arena was at the bottom of a little slope, and people parked their cars on there, and you could see over the car in front of you, and so it was a. I don't know. I went there several times. I had a lot of fun there.
Have you ever heard of a Marine Corps general named General Fox?
I don't think so, but I may
Yeah.
have.
Well, he's from Montana. He's an incredible guy, and I'm sure he's retired now because he was close to it when I was in. But I remember being at an award ceremony, and General Fox just knew a little bit about me that somebody told him. And another general was asking what my plans were, and at that point, it was evident that I was going to be medically retired, and I at the time was thinking about going back to college in Montana and studying history and becoming a professor. And before I could answer, this other gentleman who'd asked me, General Fox came up and he said, this young man's going back to his ranch. And General Fox had gone to college at Bozeman, and he had been on the rodeo team. And as far as he could tell, we were the only officers in the Marine Corps that had gone to college and rodeoed. And you could kind of hear in his voice that he had had that opportunity at some point and had turned it down. He had not gone back to the ranch. And
I see.
it was a moment that will stick with me forever, because it altered completely the direction of my life. Just a sentence like that. And got a lot of respect and admiration for him. And I doubt I'll ever see him again, but I would sure like to tell him thank you if I ever do.
Well, good. Ranch life, once you, I can, if my family had owned the ranch instead of just working there, I'd probably stayed there my entire life.
And how is it that you came to be in Big Timber?
Well, my wife was from Big Timber, and I'm not the only one that's moved to where their wife was from, but I got an opportunity. She knew the chairman of the board of the local bank and introduced me to him, and first thing I was working for him.
Yeah. And what did you do for the bank?
Well, I was a loan officer for a long time. Did a lot. I mean, and most of our customers are ranchers, or and in the early days when I was here, there were quite a few sheep too, but they're mostly cattle ranches now. And for the last, I can't remember now, about 8 or 9 years, I was the president of the bank.
Now
Which is
that
part of the reason I didn't get my that book I my book done
yeah, you're
in the
working.
90s instead of the 20s.
Yeah, you're working. The average age of a rancher or farmer in the United States is 57 and a half years old now. That's the average age. And we're losing tens of thousands of ranches and farms every year. And to get into ranching, if you were to take money and buy a ranch to run cattle on it, do you see any way that ever pencils out?
Well, if you look at the history of agricultural land values, they've gone up at a fairly steady over since the Depression. They've gone up. This is the Depression of 29. Since then, they've gone up at an average, and I haven't looked for the last 4 or 5 years, but they over that period of time, they increased in value around 1 to 2% a year on average. Except there was a bubble in the 70s, and if you drew a line on a graph with constant dollars, you would see a little bubble up and down. It goes from the trend line, right in within a few years, right back to the trend line, and kept going up. I think the last few years it's gone up, at least in Montana, it's gone up a lot more rapidly than previously. So the way you make money in ranching is be able to stay in it long enough for the land values to increase enough so that you have a profit.
Okay.
There are years when you can have a profit anyway, but over the long run, I think I think a lot of my customers over the years thought they were raising cattle, and they were raising cattle, but it was just something for them to do while the land values went up. Now that I'm joking a little, but that's
Okay.
how that kind of makes any economic sense.
So if you were to buy a ranch now and stock it with cattle and run cattle on it, sell your beef, and your goal, the only way out of it sounds like, would be to just get your bills paid every year, hope to break even, and then at the end of it, sell your land so that you can go retire someplace else.
That I don't know. That's probably an exaggeration, but there's some truth to that. Cattle are high right now, and they're bringing. Most ranchers are doing reasonably well if they don't have too much debt. The amount of debt you have is a critical number, because that interest bill and those land payments are a big deal. And it a lot of times they're the difference between whether you can live comfortably or whether you have to worry about having to be, getting foreclosed on.
Yeah. Well, it's something that scares me a lot. I think that it's going to be important to have ranchers and to have farmers going into the future, because we need people who are taking care of the land and producing food, producing leather, producing wool. And if we lose that, if that population continues to get older and gets to the point where they're too old to be able to physically do it before we get to a stage where technology can do it for them, then we'll reach a point of collapse, it feels like.
I hope not. I don't know. I don't know that we'll reach a point of collapse, but it's hard to have these older people, and a lot of them, I mean, if that 57 is the average age, they've got grown kids that are probably off doing something else that may not return to the ranch or the farm. And so you're losing a lot of just knowledge there in that transition. But I don't know. I technology has actually the re part of the reason that the age can be that old. And if it's the average age, there's a bunch of guys older. There's probably a lot of guys my age running ranches, is because the of the new balers and the big bales and the great big tractors that are not quite automated, but stuff that in the 50s or the 40s what had all been done by hand is an awful lot of that's done by machinery. And of course that takes fuel and things like that. So if you've got a fuel problem, I haven't heard them. I've heard them talking about electric cars, but I haven't heard about electric tractors yet. But
It'd take a lot of watts to run a combine.
yeah, it would.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It scares me. And if the only retirement plan for folks who are getting into it is to sell, then how do these places ever make it to the next generation? It's just complicated. And a lot of people's sort of reaction is like, well, this is something we need to subsidize. And I don't think that that's a good solution either. You know, I would love to see a world where ranching is profitable and people can continue doing it, and you can develop that generational knowledge and develop efficiencies that travel through the generations so that people can continue doing this in perpetuity.
I'd go for that.
Yeah, we'll see. But you know, I think folks might have to pay a little bit more for a piece of beef, and I don't know if they're going to be willing or able to do that. So
Don't know either.
tough scene. Are you still raising roans?
I haven't had a colt. I bred one mare this year and she lost her colt.
Oh
But
no.
so I don't have a stud right now, and I raised roans for years and years and years, but I haven't. I'm thinking I'll probably breed that mare again next year. So we'll see. I may
Why
not be done yet.
roans?
Well, you know that my dad had a roan stud, a roan Hancock bred stud, and I grew up riding him, and it. I had a son of his that I had for a stud for a long time that sired nothing but roan colts. I like roans, and it's just because I grew up around them and grew up riding them. But there's nothing magic about roan.
Well, there's something magic about them. They're pretty to look at. They're quite a
Oh
horse.
yeah, no, there's something magic about all horses, and I think the ones that I grew up riding, the ones I raised, were really good horses. I mean, they a lot of cow sense. They would, stuff you could rope on, do ranch work on. That's what I was trying to raise.
Yeah. I had a horse that was Hancock and Doc Bar, I think. And it was a really cowy horse and short, and it was great to team rope off of because it just rated those cattle so hard that, you know, it was a really short throw and the horse was always in the right position. And it's a pleasure to be able to ride a horse that's really got good cow sense, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It's a great thing. And I don't know, the horses I've always had just had it in them. I mean, that just so I didn't have to teach them.
Yeah.
I had to kind of guide them a little, but not teach them because it
Yeah.
was there.
Yeah. Well, what else is new in the great state of Montana? Bozeman seems like a bit of a tragedy these days, and seems like just about anywhere in the place is getting folks moving there that aren't necessarily interested in agriculture. What's your sense on the direction that the state's going right now?
Well, at least in Bozeman and Missoula areas, there are people moving there for hunting or skiing or fishing or just to get away from the bigger cities, and it's certainly changed. The Gallatin Valley was a great agricultural place, and now there's a lot less agriculture than there was because there's houses over a lot of that land, and some of that land was as good as you could get. I know that my cousin husband managed a ranch there right on the west edge of Bozeman. It was 800 acres, and he could run 800 cows there year round. He could
Wow.
graze it and put up enough hay to run them there year round. And boy, that's just pretty amazing. And now there's a car dealerships and houses and everything on that land. It's really, I don't know, it's just too bad.
Yeah. No, it's kind of heartbreaking, and
It is.
it happens so fast. You know, I remember, you know, coming through Bozeman for rodeos, you could park about anywhere you wanted with a 5-horse trailer behind your truck, and God help you if you try to do that today.
I wouldn't even, yeah. I pull a trailer around quite a lot, but you can't get parked anywhere with it. And I
Yeah.
mean, you can't even get parked at the farm and ranch stores with a trailer.
Isn't that a sign of the times?
It is. I wish they'd build bigger parking lots or something.
Oh goodness. Huh. Well, the characters in your book, are they using roans?
Actually, the Rusty Blackstone, who is the smaller steer wrestler, he and his brother-in-law are partners on bulldog teams, and their hazing mare is a blue roan.
Okay. Something that I think a lot of folks who are somewhat familiar with rodeo, but maybe not too close to it, don't realize is that a lot of these bulldoggers are not bringing their own horses to rodeos.
That's right. And actually, my Rusty and his brother-in-law, Bud, they own two sets of two dogging teams, and they mount they that's how they make a lot of the money is mounting other steer wrestlers.
Right. So if you can just fly to a rodeo, or just drive yourself, you can do it a lot more efficiently, and then you just
Yep.
rent a horse basically while you're there.
And the thing is, if you don't win anything, you don't pay. I
Oh,
mean,
really?
that's yeah. You I mean, you pay a percent of your winnings. So you, I don't know. I don't know why they don't just charge them. And maybe some of them do charge them a minimum. If I had a really good horse, somebody wanted a bulldog on, I didn't think he had much chance of winning, he'd pay me a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's some disparity in who's taking the risk there, because if you have somebody ride your horse and they don't win anything, then not only did you not make money, but maybe people are less inclined to rent your horse at the next rodeo too. That's a lot of risk there for the ownership.
It is.
Yeah, rodeo is a fascinating game. The guys that are winning are making a lot of money these days.
They are. The very few at the top are making really good money. And
Yeah.
I think some of them have sponsors and stuff that really help that along too.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you've got some bull riders that are making millions if they're doing it right, but they need to make it while they can, because like you said, there's not a lot of old bull riders out there.
No, no.
Yeah. So what's the future of this enterprise? You're gonna do you have a deal with Palmetto? Are they gonna publish future works?
I have the second one is going to come out around the 1st of December. I think you can already order it on Amazon. It's called A Montana Inheritance, and the third one I don't have a contract on is but I think it'll probably come out sometime next year, is A Montana Feud. And the fourth one is called The Canadian Horse. Actually, I would rather work Montana into the name on that, but the thing starts out with a character we've never met before, stealing a horse in Canada. And it
Nice.
becomes a big deal later in the story.
Okay. All right. I like that.
It's a steer wrestling horse, and anyway, he ends up selling him to my to a couple of my characters.
Well, before we close out, pitch me on this book. Why should people order this thing? And
Well,
who's the type of reader who's going to enjoy it the most?
I think anybody that reads a lot that's interested in rodeo or ranching would like it. But the people story, and it's pretty strong too, I think. I know that I've had a couple of women read it that weren't big into rodeo or ranching, either one, and they said they liked it for the interaction of the people. And I don't know. I hope I got that right. I think I did. I mean, I hope I made that interesting enough. It isn't like reading a mystery or anything. The story tension isn't so strong to pull you through it, but I think it's interesting enough that you'll want to read it anyway. If you get started in it. Maybe I'm an optimist.
And to be honest with you, the way that I consume books anymore is through audio. Is there an audio version of this, or is there one planned?
There's no audio version of it. I'd like to. There's an electronic version that you can get from Amazon, or I think Barnes and Noble, and there's several other places that have it available, but I don't have an audio yet.
Okay.
And I'm thinking about it, because I listen to audiobooks a lot, especially when I'm driving, and I think, I think a lot of rodeo cowboys would like this book, but they probably need it to be audio so they could listen to it going down the road.
Well, sure. And if they're timed event folks, they probably can't read in the first place, so that might really help them.
You could get in trouble saying that.
Oh, what's a header gonna do to me? I'm not scared.
Nothing, nothing. Yeah. Rope you and dally up, I guess.
I guess, yep. As long as they've got a good head start and their horse isn't throwing a fit.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, it's a pleasure to talk to you and hear some of these stories. I wish you every success for your book. That's pretty exciting that you've got something that you've worked on for 30 years and it's finally got daylight on it. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, thank you. And when writing's going good, it's a lot of fun. When it's not going good, it's awful. But I've got the same characters in all four of these books, and going into the fifth one, and I like them, and they've got so it's fun for me to write. They kind of reveal themselves as it goes on, So it's that's a lot of fun for me as a writer.
That's cool. And remind me again the best place for people to order this.
If you're in Montana, you can get it at Western Ranch Supply or Three Forks Saddlery, but it most people can get it at Amazon.com or I think Barnes and Noble has it. And I don't know if you can. There are two or three other places that are online bookstores that you can order it through as well. And I can't think of the names right now.
Okay. All right. And I'll take it one step further here. For the folks that are still tuned in, if you go and write a review of the Six Ranch podcast on Apple Podcasts, or ask a question on Spotify, if that's where you listen to it, I'll pick one of those and I'll send a book to you. So we'll run that for
Well,
the next
thank you.
couple of weeks and then I'll pick somebody and send them a copy of this book. And maybe we can get Jim to sign it for you or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
All righty, sir. Well, it's good to catch up with you. Good to see you. And I'm glad that we could do this and talk about Amber headbutting a goat on a global
Yeah.
stage. That's a lot of fun for me.
Okay, yes.
Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and we're just getting started.